It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farrant. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new piece in the Wall Street Journal found some small businesses are having a hard time repaying federal pandemic disaster loans. We'll talk to the writer behind the piece and check in on how small businesses are doing in Wisconsin. First, the COVID pandemic and economic disruption added uncertainty for a lot of people about whether they could afford housing. And some housing advocates say that added to existing problems with housing availability, affordability, and stability, especially for renters. According to studies, housing is a big concern for Americans, especially since the pandemic increased some people's concerns of getting evicted after an eviction moratorium expired late last year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you rent your home or did you in the past? Have you had concerns about not knowing where you're going to live next year, next month? How often do you or did you change where you're renting? Do you wish leases could be longer than 1 year in Wisconsin? If you're a property owner yourself, do you offer longer leases? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Chris Kirko is the founder of the Milwaukee Community Land Trust and president of Housing for All. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I've talked to you in the past, Chris, about housing affordability and availability. This concept of stability and or instability, can you talk about what that means?
Sure. Yeah. So a lot of times the idea of stability gets lost because the issue of affordable housing is so, it's such a big issue and rent controls are so controversial. But really, at least half the story is this issue of housing stability. And so there's a lot of data that show that this is a problem. So according to the Census Bureau, in the 2010s, 20 to 26% of renters moved every single year. That's very difficult to imagine that 20 to 20% of all renters move every single year. By comparison, only 5% of homeowners moved each year over that time period. And we know from other data that the renters, they're not moving because they want to move. They're moving because they have to move. But the Census Bureau, and I'm quoting here, they said that over the 2010s, we had, quote, historically low rates of renters moving. And in recent decades, before the 2010s, it was actually 30 to 35% of renters that were moving every year, or just an eye-popping one-third of renters every year have to move. And that was versus 6 to 8% of homeowners moving every year. So that is just mind-boggling. And so another way to look at those numbers is that a typical renter will move every 3 years. So there's a lot of data that shows that this issue of housing stability in the rental housing market is very important.
I know it can take a while to crunch numbers from federal agencies and things like that. Do we have a sense of what that trend has looked like, you know, in the midst of the pandemic and in the couple of years since that got started?
I think we're waiting on the American Housing Survey to come out. It'd be really interesting to see how the pandemic did affect that.
Looking at the impacts, I remember, you know, renting in my younger days, in my 20s, I was just a dude. It wasn't necessarily a big deal for me to move. Families who are not having predictable housing or having to relocate again and again, what do we know about the impact that can have on them, especially with younger kids?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the important thing to remember, like I said, the data say that a typical renter will move every 3 years, but you can lose a lot of the story if you're only looking at averages. So on our website, you can check us out. Easy to remember, Housing for Us, housing4.us. We interviewed somebody who moved 9 or 10 times between the ages of 0 and 18. He moved so many times as a kid that he couldn't even remember how many apartments or, you know, how many homes he had lived in. And let's be really clear, he was never once evicted, right? His mom had a full-time job. This is not the sort of family that's supposed to be having problems with housing. And so you can hear in his own words how challenging that was to live through that. And then the Milwaukee Community Land Trust, we had a ribbon cutting for our very first home just last week. And the mayor came, the mayor of Milwaukee came to speak because this issue is very close to him. And he told us about how he moved actually even more frequently when he was a child. He moved almost every year. And he talked about having to switch schools a half dozen times. So just imagine how difficult it is being the new kid at school, just how difficult the process of moving is, how it's just, you know, impossible to form a sense of neighborhood or a sense of community or even to just make friends if everybody's constantly moving. And it's all unnecessary. We could fix this today if we wanted to. It's all unnecessary.
Yeah. Before we get to that, the fixes you have in mind, as you mentioned, this isn't necessarily a story of people being evicted and having to find a new place. What is driving the need to move again and again, even if people would love to stay in one rental for 5, 10, 15 years?
Yeah. So it turns out there's not a lot of research on this. The author of Evicted, which won a Pulitzer Prize, Matthew Desmond, he was the author of a paper, the only one that I really found. He seemed also quite astonished at the lack of research. And so in the introduction, and I'm quoting from this, researchers had altogether stopped collecting data on forced moves. Instead of asking households to articulate their reasons for moving, researchers began inferring such reasons from aggregate patterns of neighborhood turnover. But what he found in this study, which was of Milwaukeeans over the years 2009 to 2011, he found that 14% of moves were forced. So that would be an eviction, whether legal or illegal eviction, a landlord foreclosure, or the building was condemned. So that was 14% of moves. And then the rest of this is kind of, I think, unsatisfying. So he classified the rest of the moves 40% as responsive and 46% as voluntary. The responsive moves included things like the landlord raises rent to an unaffordable level. The housing is so low quality that people wanted to move out. A lack of response to maintenance requests. Unsafe conditions. Unsanitary conditions. You know, those sound like forced moves to me. And then for the 46% that was voluntary, people didn't feel safe and they moved to a safer neighborhood. Maybe they moved in with relatives for financial reasons, or they were moving out from living with relatives because it's hard living with relatives. Among the voluntary, the ones that did seem actually voluntary were family changes, right? So somebody got married, a child was born, and they needed a bigger place. But for the most part, the vast majority of tenant moves are not for good reasons, like, you know, a marriage or the birth of a child. The moves are things like the housing was low quality. The rent got raised past what they could afford. It was unsafe. So, you know, something like that.
We're talking about housing instability, especially among renters. Chris Kirko is with us with the Milwaukee Community Land Trust and Housing for All. You can join in if you have a story to share, a question at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Andy is with us in Appleton. Andy, hi.
Hey, pleasantries, Rob and Chris from Appleton. I have we're so sick of the elections, but I do have an election-related question to renters. I know the Marquette Law poll said that when the voter ID was implemented in Wisconsin, that it really suppressed votes, especially in urban areas. My first thought was, that's renters. And, Rob, when you said you're in your 20s, you moved a lot. I don't know if you changed your ID every time. The voter ID, you might be discouraged from voting because you have to go through all that to get a proper ID that shows your proper address, even though you might be moving in 6 months, and it's kind of a hassle to do that. So I kind of love conspiracy theories and is always suspicious that voter ID was intended to make it easier for the suburbs, the homeowners, to vote, whereas renters and students would not even show up because they didn't want to jump over the obstacle just
Andy,
to show up.
I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Chris, I don't know if you have thoughts on voter ID in particular, but it does raise the question. There's a lot of things in our lives that we need to tell people our address for and register via our address. If you're moving every year, say, that can be hard to do.
Right. Yeah. It's just a major headache. I don't have information kind of at the at my fingertips about that particular issue. But I do know that housing affects voting quite a bit. There was a study that was done very recently by researchers at UWM and Marquette that found that more foreclosures actually depressed voter turnout as well. So there, you know, housing is just fundamental to everything that we do and everything that we are. And, you know, including just getting out to vote without, you know, without stable housing. I think it's clear that even something like voting is affected by the instability of our housing system.
Andy, thanks for the call. We're talking to Chris Kirko, founder of the Milwaukee Community Land Trust, president of Housing for All, looking at renting stability and instability in the United States. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're currently renting, do you feel like you're in a stable place for the long haul, or do you feel like every year you're trying to reinvent the wheel? Have you had to move in your life at some point because the rent went up underneath you or the house was sold out from underneath you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Coming up, what if leases were longer? We'll hear some examples from Europe coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Chris Kirko, founder of the Milwaukee Community Land Trust, president of Housing for All, looking at renting stability and instability in Wisconsin and the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this as a renter in your life? Uncertainty as to where you're going to live next year, next month? Are you renting now? Have you in the past? What did you like about it? What didn't you? Do you wish you could get longer leases? If you're someone who rents properties, what kind of things do you see that may make it hard to provide a stable year-to-year environment for tenants? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Quick follow-up from our previous caller for voter ID. You don't need to change your driver's license when you move to vote, but you do have to prove residency and still, of course, have that photo ID. Now, Chris, we've talked in the past. You compared and contrasted renting in the United States as compared to some European countries. You found some interesting things, I understand, when it comes to the length of leases.
Yeah, that's right. You know, one thing we talk about a lot is just living in the United States, our housing system just seems normal, like, you know, the way it's supposed to be. But it's actually, our housing system is really, really extreme in how unregulated it is once we start looking at the rest of the world. And this is a really good example of that. So in Germany, Switzerland, Sweden, Austria, and the Netherlands, leases have no end date. So to try to give an idea of how this works, generally, if you're a tenant and you want to move, you have to give 3 months' notice to the landlord. The landlord, on the other hand, has no right to end that lease. So if a renter wants to stay there for 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 60 years, the landlord has no right to stop them. And actually, in Germany and Austria, children can inherit leases from their parents in a way analogous to children inheriting a home from their parents who are homeowners. And it's not unusual for people who could afford to become homeowners to choose to rent instead because it's just so favorable to be a renter. And so, you know, it's been this way for many, many decades, right? So, for example, in Austria, this law was first passed in 1917, so more than a century ago. So a lease can be ended against the tenant's wishes. It's not totally absolute, right? There are just a few exceptions that are pretty logical. So the three are, so the first is if, say, the landlord's house burns down and the landlord finds himself homeless, that would be a situation where the landlord could end the lease against the tenant's wishes because the landlord himself needs a place to live. The other way is non-payment of rent. And so if it, but even there, you know, this is a lot less strict than the United States. So for example, if a tenant in Germany has to fall behind on rent for more than the sum of 2 months of rent. So as long as they're making kind of some payments, they can be behind on rent for a pretty long time, as long as the sum that they're behind is not more than 2 months. Now, if we contrast this to Wisconsin, even if you're a minute late or a penny short on rent, the landlord can charge you a $50 fee, and then you have 5 days to make good on that. So if you can't find the money in 5 days, you're evicted. And then the third reason that a lease could be ended against the tenant's wishes in these countries would be if the tenant is destroying property. And that's pretty logical. But, you know, again, it's much more strict than in the United States, right? We have found examples of people being evicted because they didn't pick up their dog poop or trim their bushes. And I am not in support of people not picking up their dog poop, but to make somebody homeless over dog poop is pretty outrageous. So, you know, big picture, if you sign a rental agreement to rent an apartment in these countries, you basically, you know, as long as you keep your nose clean, you can stay there as long as you want, and you might even be able to pass it on to your children. You could be there for decades.
I imagine the argument against that from property owners and others might be, okay, if I'm going into this business and there are these restrictions that limit what I can do with my property, that limit my ability to, change what happens on this lot that I own, that might be a disincentive. It might lead people to not want to go into the landlording business in the first place and might result in less available housing.
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. So in the German Constitution, right, they identify housing as being, or real estate as being, fundamentally different from other types of property, right? Because shelter is a basic human need. So maybe housing shouldn't be a business at all. There's examples of municipally owned housing or public housing or not-for-profit housing or nonprofits running housing that are able to be financially self-sustaining and even thrive, renting fairly to people. We have more information on our website about this, but so much of the money that goes into, or like the loans that supports private housing, is actually owned by the federal government through Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. It's guaranteed, the mortgages are guaranteed by the federal government. So, there is public money that could step in if landlords decided this is just too much. But again, you also have to think this is the way it works in several different countries, and it's been working for a very, very long time, and there's no reason we couldn't do something like that here.
Talking to Chris Kirko with the Milwaukee Community Land Trust, president of Housing for All, looking at renting instability in Wisconsin and beyond. Chris, that might seem like a tall order to pass something like that in Wisconsin and the United States, that life lease. Short of that, what kind of solutions do you think we could have to deal with concerns about instability in rental housing?
Sure. So it turns out that contracts without an end date are actually illegal in the United States. But the state of Oregon, just in the past few years, passed a law that says that if a landlord does not renew a lease, or if they increase rent by more than 10%, the landlord has to pay the tenant a $4,500 fee for moving expenses. And so in practice, this means that the lease lasts forever, right? It's just that the lease is 1 year, but it renews every single year, unless that landlord is willing to pay that hefty fine. And so that's kind of one way to get around it.
Are we seeing actions like that in other states? Are other states looking at Oregon and saying, could we do that too?
So I've been surprised at the number of places that have passed rent controls and landlord-tenant protections. But as far as a statewide effort like that is, that was pretty spectacular. I'm not aware of any other like big state-level initiatives like that.
And I wanted to ask, in our last few minutes, you mentioned that housing opening just last week, I think you said. Can you tell us a little bit about that and the work you're doing?
Yeah, of course. So, speaking of, difficulties with the rental housing system, one way, if we're not able to improve our rental housing system, is to help people to escape the rental housing system, really, and become homeowners. And so so this particular house is being sold at an affordable price, right? $80,000 for a very nice house, and it's reserved for low-income families. And it will be forever reserved for affordable housing for low-income families. And it's really a cause that is worth supporting.
And are you looking to scale that up, to do more of these?
Oh, yeah. So I'm kind of more involved on the administrative side, but I know there is funding for another 24 houses in the next couple of years. And there's a lot in the works. It really is a cause that's worth supporting.
And do you have any thoughts if a renter is listening and concerned about instability, are there resources out there for them?
I know in Milwaukee, the social development condition, or excuse me, the SDC, the Social Development Commission, the community advocates are good resources. I unfortunately don't know about resources in the rest of the state, but I know that they're there. It was local agencies that were tasked with distributing emergency rental assistance during the pandemic. So, you know, I know these agencies exist all throughout the state, but unfortunately I don't know how to find the ones outside of Milwaukee.
Chris, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
That's Chris Kirko, founder of the Milwaukee County Land Trust and the president of Housing for All. He joined us today to talk about renting stability and instability in the United States and how uncertain renting conditions can affect tenants. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a small business expert from UW-Eau Claire to check in on how businesses around the state are recovering from the pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, it's more than just punching supervillains. Superhero stories can have a political message. We'll hear more from the creators of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. First, the federal government issued hundreds of billions of dollars in disaster loans to help small businesses during the pandemic. After some delays, those bills are starting to come due. In a new piece for the Wall Street Journal, our next guest found that some businesses are struggling to start repaying those loans, saying their business is still down at the same time as things like inflation and interest rates are high. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you run a business, did you take out one of these federal disaster loans during the pandemic? What did it mean for your business at the time? How is paying it back going? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ruth Simon is a senior special writer who covers small business and entrepreneurship for the Wall Street Journal. Ruth, welcome back to the show.
Nice to speak with you today.
Now, there were different ways that the federal government tried to help businesses get through the worst stages of the pandemic. Your piece focuses on these disaster loans. Can you remind us how those work?
Sure. These are different. Lots of people know about the federal paycheck protection program loans, which were designed to be forgiven if you met certain requirements. This is a different program. These are disaster loans. They have a 30-year term and a low fixed rate, but they are designed to be paid back. And now those bills are starting to come due.
Right, those PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program loans, they got a lot more attention, I think. I don't know if they were more widely used. How widely used were these disaster loans?
A lot of businesses and nonprofits did receive these loans. The SBA issued roughly $390 billion with a B of these COVID disaster loans to nearly 4 million small businesses and nonprofits. And for many small businesses and nonprofits, it was a key piece of aid.
And you talked to people at some of these businesses. First of all, actually, before we get that, repayment was deferred at least once or twice, right?
Yes, repayment was deferred. Initially, there was a 12-month deferral. The SBA ultimately extended that to 30 months. The thing you have to know about the deferral was you were still getting charged interest during that deferral period, but the idea was to give small businesses some time to recover before they had to start paying back their loans.
Now, you talked to some business owners who were finding it a stretch, at least to pay back some of the loans. Can you talk about some of the businesses you visited with and what you heard?
Sure. I mean, broadly speaking, I think the issue is things haven't bounced back for all the businesses. It's been an uneven recovery, and many businesses are still dealing with inflation and supply chain challenges. Some businesses, like I talked to someone who had a karate studio, and business never came back, and he had to shut it down. His loan was not huge, but it is a loan. It has to be repaid, and he is working three jobs already. So that's just one example. I also talked to the owner of a cookie shop who has used her money to expand her business, to work on her packaging, to hire a franchise consultant, and she started making payments, but I think she expected to be in a little bit of a better place than she is now.
Now, you mentioned inflation, there's interest rates. Also, some of the people you talk to are having trouble, as many businesses are, finding employees, or at least being able to afford employees at current market rates.
Wages have gone up. Filling positions has been difficult for lots of employers. And the other thing that I'd mention, too, is we have some economic uncertainty now. Some people are seeing, you know, business starting to slow again, or maybe it hasn't bounced back to the levels that they thought it would be or that it was before the pandemic.
Talking to Ruth Simon, who covers small business for The Wall Street Journal, looking at federal COVID emergency loans from a couple years back. Loan payments are starting to come due. Some businesses, that's fine. Others, Ruth finds, having trouble repaying. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we're going to talk to a small business expert here in Wisconsin. Love to hear how your small business, if you run one or work at one, is doing, for better or worse. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ruth, is there any hope of, further deferrals or anything like that for businesses in this position? We took out these loans. Economy, or our part of the economy, didn't bounce back like we were hoping it would. What's next?
So I'd say a couple things. First of all, the SBA said about a third of the borrowers made some payments during the period that their loans were in deferral, which suggests they're in okay financial shape. If you're really struggling, there is a hardship payment option. You have to ask the SBA, and they'll let you make a reduced payment for 6 months. And then you have the option to renew that for another 6 months. When I talk to the SBA, they say they are continuing to look at the issue.
And is there any interest either from the White House or for Congress in tackling this and helping businesses again in this difficult position?
I haven't heard of anything yet. We will see. We don't know how many businesses are going to have trouble making their loan payments. What we saw was that there are more than 2 million loans that repayments begin either in December or January. And I think we need to get a sense of what's happening with those to see what happens next.
And Ruth, this loan is just one part of your small business and entrepreneurship beat. We talked about some of the challenges facing businesses in general. What are you watching for next on the small business front?
I'm really keeping my eye on the economy and what that means for small businesses. What happens in the labor market? Do we have sort of a smoother landing? Do things soften more? And also, how small businesses are faring when it comes to competing with larger companies.
Ruth, thanks again for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Ruth Simon, senior special writer who covers small business and entrepreneurship at the Wall Street Journal, with us today to talk about her recent report on why some small businesses are struggling to pay back federal pandemic disaster loans. Up next, we'll zoom in on Wisconsin and how small business is doing here with the head of UW-Eau Claire's Small Business Development Center. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. As you look around your community, have you seen a change in the landscape? Were a lot of your small businesses able to survive the last couple of years? Or has there been a lot of turnover? Maybe the local company replaced by a chain of some sort, or vice versa. Are you going back to local shops, restaurants, nail salons, you name it, as much as you did before the pandemic? Flip things around. If you're a small business owner yourself, and that covers a lot of ground, I know, how are things looking for you? What are some of the challenges? What has gone well over the last couple of years? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about small businesses in Wisconsin and how or if they're recovering from the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you and your business? What have the last few months or the past few years been like for you? How can we do a better job supporting, especially local small businesses? Did you use one of the federal disaster relief loans or the Paycheck Protection Plan? How did it all work for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Luke Kempin joins us now, director of the Small Business Development Center at UW-Eau Claire. Luke, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you tell us, first of all, a little bit about what your organization does?
Well, the Small Business Development Center has a pretty straightforward mission. Our mission is to go out in the community and help people start and grow their businesses. In Wisconsin, there's 12 SBDC offices located pretty much at each one of the four-year campuses in Wisconsin. So,
now, it's been an unusual few years in the economy. I think that's a huge understatement. What are you seeing? What kind of the things are you seeing as the biggest challenges for different kinds of small businesses here in the state?
Well, I think Ruth did a nice job of kind of alluding to the four things that I'm seeing. I would say that's inflation, the employees, hiring employees and getting and finding employees, interest rates, and supply chain was a big issue, but that seems to be improving quite a bit. But along with that improving, now we have interest rates rising and inflation is still strong. So those are, seems like we're going from one thing to the next. So.
And with, we just talked to Ruth about those pandemic emergency loans hitting businesses hard if they're not ready for it. This could be a challenge for a business at any point. We took out a loan, things didn't go like we were hoping. Is there anything unusual about this in a way?
No, I think that you're right. It could happen even on a regular loan or a situation where, you know, a lot of times you're taking out these loans, you're not sure what's going to happen. Hence, you took out the loan to try to help cover what potentially could happen. And we have clients that have been able to pay back that loan. I just had a client this week reach out to me and said they paid back their entire EIDL loan, economic injury disaster loan, to the SBA. But then I've had other clients saying, is there more deferral? Is there another opportunity to defer these loans? So that's kind of where we're at. It kind of runs the gamut.
All right, let's get into some advice now. In general, if you're talking to somebody who's starting a business or maybe looking at expanding or trying to get through a tough patch and they're saying, all right, we're trying to figure out, should we take out loans? How much should we take out in loans? What do you ask them to consider? I know every case is going to be different, but what kind of things should be going through that person's mind?
Really, what we would recommend be done is that you do a set of financial projections. And that's what we do a lot of out of our UW-Eau Claire SBDC Center. A lot of our work is doing financial projections. And really, a financial projection is like a budget. It's preparing a budget for your business. And whether you're a startup or an existing business, if you're looking to take on a new activity or offer a new product or something like that, you really want to run a budget on it or run a set of projections and see what it might look like. And that would be the starting point. If it doesn't work on paper, it's probably not going to work in the real world. And even if it does work on paper, it doesn't mean it's going to work in the real world either. So
I think for a lot of people going into a small business, they might know the subject well. We heard about the karate instructor that Ruth mentioned. He might be really good at karate, or IT. I'm really good at the computer side of things, or, you know, fill in the blanks there. But that doesn't necessarily come with the business skills, the accounting, things like that. For that person who knows their subject really well, are there ways they can find that kind of help here in the state? Where do you point them to start building those budget building and business planning skills?
Yeah, I guess I would, you know, certainly check out local resources. Each community, different parts of the state have different resources available to them. And as I mentioned, the SBDC has offices throughout the state, so that's a good place to start. But also there's a lot of local entities and things that might be in your community that you should look into. There's also different types of loan programs that might be out there, some for startups. And, you know, there may be some grants available too.
We got an email from Carrie, who describes herself as a former hospitality and housing owner in central Wisconsin. Carrie emails, "The COVID pandemic created a survival of the fittest in the land of business, where the monopolies are pitted against moms and pops, the latter of which is financially weaker. These Band-Aid attempts were just that, not enough for the mass of mom and pops, only to further see the success of the monopoly organizations." There's always that concern, I think, about the playing field. Luke, did the pandemic make it worse, as Carrie says, worse for small businesses, especially those competing with bigger organizations?
I think probably in some cases it has, but I think, you know, more importantly, probably is the ability of that small business to pivot. Different things happened during COVID. I mean, we all heard of restaurants that had to close their doors, and some of these restaurants said, well, we're going all to takeout. And so they were able to pivot and adjust to things. And I've got clients that were sit-down restaurants before the pandemic that have just stayed on that, you know, pivoted to takeout and stayed and continue with takeout only. So I think there's probably some truth to that, but I think a lot of it just depends on the business's ability to pivot and make changes and to adjust to what's happening right away. And typically the smaller business is more able to do that, more nimble to make those changes.
Now, for a business person, a small business owner who feels like they're kind of treading water right now with the challenges you just mentioned, they're just kind of getting by. What's a first step in making that pivot, in evaluating what are we doing? What could we do differently given these uncertainties?
Well, I think the first step, again, I would come back to is really understanding your financial situation, understanding what if you're offering multiple products, what products are making money, what are your margins on your product? In other words, what are you selling it for? What do you have to pay to produce it or to buy that product, and make sure you have enough margin there to make it go? And you know, sometimes you see that with employees now, especially in the restaurant world. With inflation on food costs and things, we're seeing that a lot of restaurants have not been able to keep up with the rising cost and adjusting their prices, their selling prices for food. And so their margins are shrinking. So they need to be aware of that and really to, you know, really plan ahead and keep thinking about those things and keep watching things. The critical success factors of your business, you have to monitor them all the time.
And in just our last less than a minute, what are you watching for next with all these different variables going on? What do you have your eye on the most as we head into a new year when it comes to small business?
Well, I think right now what we're seeing is the interest rates are really probably a major factor, because I know the Fed is adjusting interest rates to try to knock inflation down. And it's probably working some, because we are seeing a lot of clients that have maybe pulled back on projects because the interest rate is so much higher than it had been in the past few years. I think we also have to realize, though, that still interest rates at 6% is still a pretty good rate when you look back historically. I remember my first home rate was around 12%. So we're still at fairly historically low rates, but we're not used to these types of rates. So.
Luke, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Luke Kempen, director of UW-Eau Claire's Small Business Development Center, with us for a look at Wisconsin small businesses and how they are doing. Now it's time. time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about an animal sanctuary.
Primate research has led to countless scientific breakthroughs. But when a monkey is no longer needed for research, what happens next can be an ethical quandary. In South Central Wisconsin, a team runs a sanctuary for monkeys as a way to say thank you for their contributions to science. Jana Rose Slice brings us the story.
There's a small animal sanctuary tucked away in a quiet rural area in Marquette County. Here, you'll find 9 monkeys living in habitats close to their natural environment.
That's actually Bella doing a warning call, saying stranger danger, there's visitors today. But she likes to let the other monkeys know what's going on.
That's Amy Kerwin, executive director and founder of Primates, Inc.
And then Jojo on the right, he's a green monkey. He's just 1 year old.
The monkeys living here were former research animals or pets. Kerwin used to work with 97 rhesus monkeys in a University of Wisconsin-Madison lab. She loved caring for them as they were used for biomedical research.
You know, some labs don't want your employees to grow close to the animals, but since the monkeys are so like us, it's almost inevitable. You're going to grow close to them, so why not help facilitate and give a chance so they can give back?
Kerwin has set out to do just that. When an animal is no longer needed for research, it has few options. It costs thousands of dollars for one monkey's retirement care.
It costs just hundreds of dollars to be able to euthanize a monkey to free up their cage or sell them to more research than you actually make money. So the motivation to retire is an ethical compromise.
After learning about the barriers monkeys face getting into retirement, especially in Wisconsin, Kerwin decided to make a change. She started Primates, Inc. so the retired monkeys can live their lives as close to their wild counterparts as possible. It's also a way to thank them for their contributions to science. Fallon Mullen also used to work with monkeys in a research lab and is now the animal care manager at Primates, Inc. She's responsible for the day-to-day care of the monkeys.
This is Mars, just turned 16, like I said. He is a rhesus macaque male as well, also from the biomedical industry, and he's paired with Timon, who everyone calls Sweet Timon because she's just so kind of timid and really, really sweet-natured.
Many of Primates, Inc. residents have never lived in their natural environment. Staff maintain greenhouses, raised walkways, and indoor and outdoor spaces for the monkeys. Mullen says this encourages natural behaviors like foraging, grooming, and playing.
But we've never seen a monkey actually swim. They'll sit in the pool. The pools are, you know, like either like kiddie pools that you would imagine or like turtle sandbox, you know, about that depth. So not real deep. But the monkeys in the past have, you know, like I said, just sat in them, waited in them.
But Mullen says that changed when a pair of surrendered pets showed up.
But Noah, who is a rhesus macaque male, he is paired with Maddie. We just gave them their pool this month. And he can be seen actually swimming. So he goes under the water and does several circles and will come up for air. And it's just so amazing to see because he didn't learn this from the other monkeys here. So this was just like his natural instinct coming out. And also such a great story about why monkeys should have the opportunity for retirement. It's just so amazing.
Kerwin hopes to grow Primates, Inc. to house 100 monkeys because she sees the impact retirement in a natural environment can have on former research animals.
Jana Rose Slice brought us that story about an animal sanctuary. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, take a trip to the movies at the theater or on your screen at home. Kate's guest shares holiday movie recommendations, great films for the season, and you can too. And you can get started right now. If there is a favorite holiday movie, past or present, or something you've actually seen that's out new, this month, maybe, let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. It's Movie Talk tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Do you have a meal that's become a classic, maybe in your family, or something you make whenever you're cooking for guests or a potluck? We want to hear about it. Tomorrow on Food Friday, Deb Perlman from Smitten Kitchen is back with us. She has a collection of new classic recipes, things she says will stand the test of time and make great additions to our cooking rotations. She's going to give us some great cooking ideas, and you can too. Tell us about your household classics, whether they're generations old or something you just discovered last year. Email now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You don't have to send in the whole recipe. I won't stop you if you want to. Share the recipe so nice you make it twice or more. Email ideas@WPR.org and then join us tomorrow for Food Friday. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.